Here's what you need to know about today. 70% of Americans are saying they are against a war with Iran. Donald Trump's approval ratings are at a record low. How low can he go? And will those low numbers make him more or less aggressive toward Iran? History gives us two different answers. And who's going to win this game of chicken between the United States and Iran at this point? Or do we all lose? Do we all lose in the end? This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's get started. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Millions upon millions of you watched our reporting from Iran. And look, I read your comments. And while most of you were generally positive, I was amazed by how many enemies I made. People were really mad that I was sharing the Iranian point of view. Some of you said I should be arrested. Others said that I should be taken care of, whatever that means. I think I know what it means. I think you want me killed, right? And many of you said that everything I did was orchestrated by the Iranian government because I couldn't possibly be freely talking to people on the streets of Iran. Well, guess what? You're wrong. You just are. I was there. The people I talked to, I literally picked them off the streets. I would just go up to somebody with a microphone and I would start talking as they were walking by. And then there was the moment with the kids, which for some reason is the most viewed video. It's gotten millions and millions and millions of views all over the world and shares, right? People showing this to other people they know, I guess. More than any other clip that we posted, including interviews with the foreign minister and the heads of the government. By the way, and that interview with the kids, it was completely organic. Now, a lot of people are saying this was not. They say, no. That was orchestrated by the government somehow. They put those kids there. Maybe paid them. I want you to watch it for yourself.
Yay!
You like America?
Yes. Hi.
Good pizza in America.
You're Indonesian?
Welcome to Iran.
Thank you. That's so nice.
What? How are you? What's your name? What's your name?
My name is Richard.
Richard.
What is your name?
My name is Sandra.
Nadani. Oh.
Nadani.
That's a beautiful.
Nice to meet you.
My name is
Bye-bye.
They're just kids. They're kids. That's why, I mean, I got to tell you, I was kind of stunned when I read the attacks against us. Against me and against the kids. People criticizing the kids. How dare they? What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? You say those kids were plants? That whole thing was staged? Seriously? I mean, I can't believe I have to explain this, but let me explain this, okay? Here's what happened. I was preparing a walking stand-up toss to J.D. Vance, the vice president of the United States, regarding Saudi Arabia and nukes, a story that I was working on and covering while I was there, when suddenly I noticed a group of kids that had gathered around a school bus that they were preparing to board because they were, I guess, getting ready to go to school. Just, you know, one of those situations. They were there. I was there. I talked to them. They were curious. They were friendly. They were approachable. They were fun. They're kids. I mean, I didn't see them as Iranian kids. I just saw them as kids. That's why I interacted with them. It wasn't a ploy. And yes, it was completely organic. No plans, no orchestration, just a human interaction. There's another one. So I was walking down the street and I find a man dressed as, I guess, what is self-described there as a mullah. So given everything that's been written about them and said about them in the past, I became curious. I went over to him with a microphone and I started talking to him. And I asked him questions right here in the middle of downtown Tehran. Watch. Pardon me for my ignorance, but you're dressed as a religious man. What is your title religiously?
Mullah. I think in other country,
Mola, yes.
You know, it's funny, in America and in the West, sometimes when they say mullah, people become afraid, like, oh, the mullahs, like they're bad people. But you're not a bad person.
You know, we should talk with the other people about their opinion. I'm simple people like other people.
You're not.
It makes no difference. This dress shouldn't separate mullahs with other people.
Is it okay to question the leader? Is it okay to question your president or the supreme leader and say, wait, no, I don't agree. Can you disagree?
I think they understand better because they have a helicopter opinion.
Is it okay for the people to disagree? Is it okay for the people to protest? You say no or yes as a man, as a mullah.
Yes.
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 Yes. It's a conversation. Many of you argue that I had no right to even be in this country, a country that I was about to be bombed, that it's a government situation, not for people like me, that it wasn't my place, right? But you know what? I would argue that I was there because it seemed that it was a place that it was that was about to be bombed. That's what made it my place. Isn't that when questions most need to be asked before the bombs fall? You know, questions like, who are these people? What do they say? What do they want? What do they know? And what do they want us to know about them? Which leads us to where we are right now. Will President Trump bomb Iran? He says he will. In fact, he's now sending a second aircraft carrier to apply, quote, maximum pressure. But if he goes through with this and Iran responds in kind by setting the Gulf region on fire, shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, then what, right? Look at this poll. 70% of Americans right now, people in America, are saying they do not want him to bomb Iran. That's according to Quinnipiac, one of the best polling institutions in the United States. Fact is, Mr. Trump is not in a strong position right now, given the domestic situation and the geopolitical situation for him. Look at these polls. I'm going to share some polls with you that just came out. This is the first one is according to Pew Research. Again, very reliable polling institution. 61% of Americans disapprove, and this is because of ICE and many other things that have been going on in the country, disapprove of Mr. Trump's presidency, right? Here's another one. Look at this headline I'm about to show you. This is Forbes. Forbes is important because Trump loves Forbes because it's a very conservative magazine and writes about business, right? He reads it. They say his numbers are even worse in February than they were back in January. According to their reporting, 62% of Americans disapprove of the way he is handling the presidency. And as bad as that is, all right, what I'm about to show you here is even worse. Axios is citing three brand new polls that say Americans think that Biden did a better job as president than Mr. Trump is now doing as president. Ouch, right? Ouch. So given that, is Trump in a place where he wants to start a war in the Gulf that could drive up oil prices, destabilize the region? Some say it would be something he might want to do politically. And you're saying, what? Yeah, to distract voters. Think Clinton, think Bush. Polls are down. Let's do something that gets everybody to rally around the country. Give them a cause, right? I mean, I don't know. That's one perspective. You buy that? Here's what may be Mr. Trump's specific problem that maybe those presidents didn't have at the time. Americans, and especially Republicans, his party right now, are especially angry at the establishment. Think Epstein, think wars, think Ukraine, think money lost, think inflation, put all those things together. They're angry at the establishment for engaging in needless wars, wasting their money. That's the American mindset right now. And for the first time ever, by the way, they're also angry with the establishment for not questioning Israel. First time in my lifetime I've heard this in public opinion polls. Even very prominent Jewish Americans are coming out publicly for the first time ever and pushing back against Israel. Here's one just recent example that makes us go, wow, this is different. This is an American Jewish actor and singer. His name is Mandy Patinkin.
And I ask Jews all over the world to consider what this man, Benjamin Netanyahu, and his right-wing government is doing to the Jewish people all over the world. They are endangering not only the state of Israel, which I care deeply about and want to exist, but they are endangering the Jewish population all over the world. He is the most dangerous thing, not just since October 7th. It has been a deeply troubled situation.
And endangering the Jews by endangering those in Gaza.
And to watch what is happening for the Jewish people, to allow this to happen to children and civilians of all ages in Gaza, for whatever reason, is unconscionable and unthinkable. And I ask you Jews everywhere all over the world to spend some time alone and think, is this acceptable and sustainable? How could it be done to you and your ancestors? And you turn around and you do it to someone else.
It's an emotional moment in the United States. And, you know, conversations like that are being had at dinner tables all over the country. But it comes down to the question that we're left with, that you and I and so many others are looking at right now. Is it the place of the United States of America, my country, by the way, to force Iran to give up its nuclear enrichment, to give up its missiles, to give up its allies, which are antagonistic to Israel? And worse, is it the United States' place, and indirectly Israel's place, to do this by force, as the threat is right now on the table? Two guests today to talk about this. They have contrasting opinions. Yoni Ben-Menachem is an Israeli journalist who's good enough to join us. He's worked as a Middle East correspondent and as a commentator, and we're very happy to have him here. Presently, by the way, he's a senior researcher at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. We also are joined by Chris Halali. Christopher is also a journalist. He's a researcher. He's a geopolitical analyst who recently made news from his coverage of the war in Ukraine. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Let's get right to this. And Christopher, I want to start with you. Is Israel right to be asking a country they consider an enemy to rebuke their nukes or their ability to seek to have nukes, weapons?
The simple answer I would say is no, because Israel itself has an illegal nuclear program. It is a non-signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it has not allowed any inspector to ever come to the Dimona facility or to inspect Israeli nuclear reactors and nuclear weapons. And therefore, Israel asking other countries in the region to give up their nuclear civilian program is, of course, the definition of hypocrisy. If Israel wants to be a member of the international community and uphold international norms and standards and to have a viable diplomatic relation with neighboring Arab states and also with Iran as a Persian state, then they must also play by the same rules in the international system. They must allow inspectors in.
Let's give Mr. Menachem a chance to respond to that. What would you say to that, Mr. Menachem?
First of all, there's no proof that Israel is a nuclear weapon or whatever he is saying. It's only things that are in the press, in the media. Nobody has established that Israel really have such a program and making nuclear weapons. The second thing is Israel is not threatening to destroy any country, for instance, Iran, while the leaders of Iran are saying every day that they want to destroy the what they call the Zionist entity. They mean Israel, and when they are saying it almost every day, the top leaders of Iran. So Israel has the right to fear that if they have a nuclear weapon, they will use it against Israel. So I think this is a natural fear.
I think it's generally understood, though, that Israel does have nukes. I think it kind of goes without saying. Are you saying that Israel does not, without qualification, have any kind of nuclear weapon?
I'm not familiar with what Israel has or no, but I didn't see any proof that I can tell you. If you can provide the proof, then we can deal with it.
Chris, let me take it back to you then. What do you think?
Of course, we have testimony from the likes of Mordechai Vanunu, who is still basically a prisoner in Israel. He's not allowed to leave the country, and he was imprisoned for decades because he exposed Israel's nuclear program as one of the persons with knowledge of the nuclear program. And it has been commonly understood, as you rightfully point out. The main question here is, does Israel have the right to condemn a civilian nuclear program? There is no evidence that Iran has a military nuclear program or has militarized its civilian nuclear program. Does Israel have the right to condemn Iran for its civilian nuclear program? And the answer is no.
But doesn't Iran say, as the foreign minister told me just a few days ago, that they're willing to do a deal where they have a very small amount of uranium enrichment, only enough to be able to make isotopes for cancer patients and to have electricity for their people. Mr. Menachem, do you not accept that, if that's what they're willing to agree to, that we should just agree to that and walk away, no war?
Look, first of all, concerning what he mentioned about what is called the Israeli spy, Mordechai Vanunu. This is an old story, and many people in Israel believe it was just an Israeli propaganda or psychological warfare in order to deter Iran or other countries that are planning to build a nuclear weapon. And as for the nuclear intentions of Iran, President Trump said himself, based on the intelligence information, after he ordered the bombing of the Fordo nuclear facility, that the Iranians were only a few weeks away from manufacturing a nuclear weapon. So this shows, and this is based on intelligence, so whom should we believe? So I don't think that President Trump would come out and say that without an established and proven intelligence information that the intelligence community in the United States provided him.
But Mr. Trump also said recently that they bombed them and destroyed their nuclear facilities and their nuclear weapons. So why would you want to bomb them if you've already said you've destroyed their nuclear facilities, unless you're doing it just for the sake of bombing them?
Because this is true. He said that. I'm not responsible to what he said. But he also said that there are about 400 kilograms of enriched uranium that are still buried in those sites that were bombarded by the American airplanes and Israeli airplanes. So what they want to do, apparently, I'm not familiar with the American plans. I think they want to bomb these sites again to make sure that the Iranians cannot take out the enriched uranium, which is still buried in those sites.
Let me ask you, Chris, about the other two issues here, and that is what the Israelis want, not just that they would diminish their enrichment capacity, but also that they would diminish their missiles that they seem to have and have, in fact, boosted in recent years through the help of apparently both Russia and China. And they also want ties cut off between Iran's allies, which have historically been antagonistic to Israel. So those are the things that Israel wants from Iran. Fair, not fair?
Of course, not fair. Iran, as an independent sovereign country, has every right to maintain a military. It has a military, it has a standing army, an air force, a navy, it has a special forces. It is allowed to do that. It is a right of an independent state to do that. Iran is allowed to have a missile program. Israel itself has a missile program. Nobody condemns Israel for its program, whether it be offensive or defensive. The same is true for Iran, and Iran has said that its missiles are defensive. I'd like to point out as well that it was Israel that attacked Iran first. We remember that Israel bombed the embassy of Iran in Syria, killing military and diplomatic personnel. That is an act of war. That's a casus belli. And for those who know international law, that was the first strike. Then came Iran's response, which was proportional. Now it has been a slow escalation from there. But Iran has every right to have a program that is allowed for defensive capabilities. Iran has never used its ballistic missile program offensively. It has only used it defensively. And that must be clarified, and that must be said to the world, because those who follow the news understand the chronology and the timeline of all of this. Regarding the allies in the region, Iran has said those allies operate also on their own. Yes, they are allies, but they also are resistance organizations within their own countries. Israel is currently bombing the south of Lebanon in violation of a ceasefire. Israel has bombed Yemen, and the Yemeni resistance is also proportional defensive maneuvers and actions. And the same is true throughout the region. So Iran, even if you cut relations, those resistant groups will still continue to resist because Israel is an aggressor state to their states.
Speaking of aggressors, let's take the first point first. The fact that I just heard Mr. Halali say that it was actually the Israelis who've been the aggressors, as they were the aggressors in the 12-day war. You say what about that, Mr. Menachem?
Look, these proxies of Iran, like Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis in Yemen and the pro-Iranian militias in Iraq, they're all terror organizations that are equipped with the missiles and drones by the Iranians in order to, what they call, make a firewall surrounding Israel to try and strangle Israel with missiles and the drones. And what Israel did in Syria, the attack on the Iranian embassy, was a preemptive strike because they were planning attacks on Israel from this embassy, just was a headquarters of the Revolutionary Guards. As for what your guest said about Iran never using missiles to attack other countries, this is completely wrong. We saw what happened on September 2019 when they attacked Saudi Arabia with the missiles, ballistic missiles and drones, and they destroyed half of the oil facilities of the Aramco company, the oil industry of Saudi Arabia. So we see what is happening in the Middle East. They're using these weapons in order to gain power and trying to control some of the Sunni countries, and also planning to destroy the state of Israel by missiles, drones, and also planning to manufacture nuclear weapons. So it's only the right of Israel to defend itself. And since we know exactly what the Iranians' intention, and since they are saying it out loud, they're not even trying to hide it. They just come out every day saying they will destroy Israel. So what do you want Israel to do? And what do you expect Israel to do?
And I understand
And you're saying, you know, you call these proxies antagonistic to Israel. They're not antagonistic. They're terror organizations trying terror attacks on Israel. It's not a matter of antagonistic or not. They are just terror organizations.
As you know, sir, we live in a world where one man's terrorist is another man's patriot. So the labels these days are not as clear as maybe they would have been a few decades
ago.
Okay,
no, of course you are entitled. You're entitled to use any terminology you want to. Of course, I'm not. I'm just telling you the way I see it.
Let me ask you a question, because I hear what you're saying. As an Israeli, you hate Iran. And you want to punish Iran.
No, we don't hate Iran. No, this is not true. We love the Iranian people, and we used to have good relations with the Iranian people. The problem is the leadership of this that was imposed on this on the Iranian people in the Islamic Revolution in 1979. This is a very extreme religious jihadi leadership that is not only a danger to Israel, it's a danger to the whole Middle East. And, you know, if you go through the history, you'll see the relationship with the Arab countries surrounding them And you will see exactly what I'm talking about. It's not the, only the problem of Israel. It's the problem of the Gulf countries. The, actually, every country in the Middle East suffers from Iran.
A lot of people would say it's the opposite. They say a lot of people in the Middle East suffer from Israel, and that it's because of Israel that there was a war in Syria, a destabilization in Libya, that there's been problems in Yemen, and now there there was a war in Iraq, and a war in Afghanistan, and now a war in Iran.
If what you're saying is true, how do you explain that we have a peace treaty with Egypt, with Jordan, with the Arab Emirates,
money,
with Bahrain?
Money.
How do you
money,
say that?
Money. They're paid by the United States money. To stay out. Well, they are, sir. I can actually show you the numbers of how much money the United States gives to Egypt so that they will stay quiet, as well as Jordan and many of the Gulf states.
This is true.
They do.
That they get money from the United States, but they are also allies of the United States. They just don't get it because they have a peace treaty with Israel. They are the allies of the Americans.
Chris, let's bring you back into this. I see you over there patiently waiting to have your comment. Who is most responsible for the destabilization or the continued destabilization of the Middle East? He's arguing it's Iran and it, front and center. You would argue Israel?
I absolutely would argue Israel. I think that a lot of problems in the Middle East would be solved if there was a peace agreement and a declaration of a Palestinian state on 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. This is what the United Nations has spoken about, the Security Council. This is what the Russian Federation would want, what China wants, what many other major powers want. The only two countries that don't want this are Israel and the United States, even though the United States pays lip service to the two-state solution. Now, if there is a Palestinian state and there are rights for Palestinians, I think that a lot of the impetus and energy around some of the violence that we see in the region will dissipate because people are angry with the treatment of the Palestinians. We just had what many have declared a genocide, not what I say or you say, what international organizations have said, what international legal organizations have said, humanitarian organizations have said, have condemned what happened in Gaza and the hundreds of thousands killed and wounded as a genocide. So we have to solve these issues. But Israel now, seeking to expand the conflict, seeking to further spread and fan the flames, does not help peace in the region. And in fact, Egypt, Jordan, the Gulf states, they also have their own domestic issues to deal with their populations, who are angry with the fact that their countries are not supporting the Palestinians and not supporting. Sure, they have peace agreements with Israel, but that's only at the top. The base of the population is angry that there is no solution for the Palestinian people, and that, in fact, instead of it being contained, it has spread now to multiple countries in the region. Multiple countries have been destabilized. And I want to emphasize one thing. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has, since the 1990s, stated that Iran was, at first 5 years, then 3 years, then 1 year, then weeks, months, days away from a nuclear weapon. To this date, Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. This fear-mongering, this projection, and this push towards war will not help anyone in the region except those who desire this war, which are the Israelis and their backers in the West. I want to just say, the people of Iran, as you rightfully know, you saw them on the street, they don't want war. They want peace. But ultimately, they want their rights, they want their dignity, and they want their nation protected.
Well, I was pressing Mr. Menachem. Let me press you a little bit there, Chris. You say you condemn the slaughter of innocent Palestinians, which no doubt has been taking place in Gaza. I think that's undeniable. Would you also condemn then, if proven, the reaction of the Iranian government against protesters?
Listen, if there's violence against civilians, we, of course, under international law, all of that violence is condemnable. Absolutely. And of course, there are mistakes made, there are issues made, but I think that, as you know, the Iranian government has worked overtime to ensure peace and stability in the country and has been met with not ordinary protests, has been met with violent protests. When violent protests happen, of course, the government takes necessary maximalist tactics to try to protect social stability and order. So certainly, people were killed on both sides. This is not a rocket science. And of course, we condemn any violence in any case. I'm a man of peace. But one thing has to be clear. It is not the Iranian government who fired the first shots in this situation. It was those violent protesters who, by the way, were armed by the West. John Bolton made it clear that those arms are transferred from Iraq, especially from the Kurdistan region, over the border into Iran, that they were using Kalashnikovs, shotguns. They were hosing people down with gas and burning them with homemade flamethrowers. This is appalling behavior. So, of course, there's violence. We condemn all violence. We want peace and stability for everyone's children and grandchildren. But the one thing is clear. There cannot be a violent solution to bring about peace in the region. There has to be diplomacy.
Let me ask that question of Mr. Manahin. Isn't it hypocritical for Israel and the United States to argue that Iran should be bombed because the government was hard on its protesters, given what Israel has done to the civilians in Gaza?
Look, you are distorting the facts. What the Iranian regime did, I will explain.
Okay.
What the Iranian regime did was the massacre of about 40,000 innocent civilians who just went out to the streets to protest against the regime, and they did not have any weapons. This is all Iranian propaganda, and nobody smuggled weapons for them, and they just massacred them in one day. On the 9th of the month, they massacred about between 30,000 to 40,000 innocent protesters.
To be fair, their number is 3,500. So they're at 3,500, and you're at 40.
No, this is the official number. This is what the Iranian regime is saying. But the evidence, and I saw all the videos that are coming out from Iran. And we see thousands of bodies in this.
Let's use that number. Let's say it's 40,000. Israel has killed 80,000 Palestinians. You've doubled that.
Listen, what you forgot to mention is that the massacre that Hamas did while invading Israel on October the 7th, 2023. And massacred 1,500 people, most of them civilians.
No, 350 of them were civilians, sir. There wasn't one. Most of them were not civilians.
Even one is enough.
I agree.
Even one civilian is enough. And they invaded. They violated the peace agreement, the ceasefire agreement. And they invaded Israel and carried out this massacre. And I didn't hear any condemnation from you or from your guests to this massacre of the Israelis. Now, for the high casualties number of the Palestinians in Gaza, to answer your question, is that this is a result of the Hamas using the Gaza civilians as human shields.
Human shields.
And they build their tunnels and build their fortifications under houses, under hospitals,
but we're back to this. Don't you see the difference, though? I mean, when Iran does it, they're criminals, they're monsters, they're terrorists. But when Israel does it, well, they have a right to do it, even though Israel's number doubles Iran's.
It's pure hypocrisy.
I did not say that. War is ugly everywhere. Nobody supports war. But as for achieving peace in the Middle East, and especially with the Palestinians, I want to remind you that the Palestinians have a representative, which is the official representative of the Palestinian people, is the PLO. And Israel signed with the PLO in 1993 the Oslo Accords, and which are still effective. And according to these accords, they have to, both sides have to solve the Palestinian problem through negotiations and not through violence.
So and how about
Hamas
settlements?
Come out and makes this attack on Israel.
Let's give Mr. Hilali a chance to respond. He's been listening for quite a while. I just want to make it as fair as possible a conversation. Go ahead, Chris.
I think it's very hypocritical that somehow, you know, we can kill 80,000, no problem, and war is brutal and war is ugly. Then the resistance has every right to fight on behalf of those 80,000 against Israel. War is ugly. You said it yourself. I don't have to put words in your mouth. You said it. War is ugly. Therefore, Israel imposed this war.
I repeat it. Yes,
no problem. No problem. So Israel must reap what it sows. That's a simple fact. If Israel wants to destabilize the region, then the region will respond proportionally or asymmetrically.
So you support the continuation of the war, from what I hear from you.
Listen, I support a Palestinian state. You don't want to make a Palestinian state? People will fight for a Palestinian state. You don't want to have peace in the region? People will fight for peace in the region.
This is legitimate.
This is legitimate right of the Palestinian people to have a state. You don't want to give them a state? They will impose a state.
They are entitled to demand a Palestinian state according to the agreements, but also Israel is entitled to not to agree. So the solution...
Sure, no problem. Then we solve it by military means.
The solution has to come through negotiation, as was agreed upon in the Oslo Accords, not by violence.
Does negotiations include the expansion of settlements, the taking of land, the dispossession, the destruction of houses, of schools, of hospitals?
When Yasser Arafat signed these agreements in 1993, there was no even one item in these accords forbidding Israel to expand settlements.
It's forbidden under international law. It doesn't have to be in the agreement. International law says it's forbidden.
Let me ask
you. The Palestinians could have refused to sign these so-called Oslo Accords, but they signed it. So. And it doesn't forbid Israel to expand the settlements.
Then prepare for war. What do you want? What do you want us to say? You want to expand and then prepare for war.
Let's get back to the case at hand. And I want to go back to that the actor in the United States who made that point. Mr. Menahem, are you concerned about the reaction globally against your country that you love, because Israel has kind of become, in the eyes of the world, whether it's justified or not, kind of a pariah country right now because of what they've done. Do you accept any culpability on the part of the Netanyahu government for that, or do you think it's all just crap made up by the media?
No, of course Israel is a problem internationally. An image problem, and Israel has to work on it to improve it. I agree with you on this point, but this war that started more than 2 years ago was imposed on Israel. Israel did not initiate this war and did not attack Gaza. Israel was attacked by Hamas from Gaza, which invaded Israel and carried out a horrific massacre. And Israel had to protect itself. And I think that everybody understands now that this terror organization, which is for some reason you call it resistance, has to disappear from the world if we want peace between Israel and Gaza. Because
I want to correct the record here.
This war
did not begin 2 years ago. This war began 1948, not only with the artificial creation of the state of Israel, but with the Nakba and the dispossession and ethnic cleansing of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their historic lands. And they still have the deeds and the titles to their property. So don't say that it started 2 years ago. It started decades ago.
Point well taken, but I want to move away from history because I've had this conversation as a broadcaster at CNN, NBC.
But he's putting the historical facts wrong.
All right, go ahead.
In 1948, there was a UN resolution to establish two states. There was a two-state solution, and Israel, a Jewish state and an Arab state, or Palestinian state, call it as you want. The Palestinian refused it, and the Arab countries attacked Israel that did not exist yet. They attacked it. This was what we call the independence war, and as a result, happened the Nakba, because the Palestinian lost in this war, and Israel was established as an independent state. So just to make the record right.
Final point on this, Chris, to finish it up, because I want to move on to something else. But would you like to put a caveat on that?
Listen, the caveat is that this state came without the discussion, without the inclusion and without any dialogue or consultation with the Palestinians.
This is based
with
on the UN resolution.
The UN resolution was imposed on the Palestinian people without their consultation.
That's
a fact.
Let's go to the president. Given what we just discussed and what you admitted, Mr. Menachem, and I thank you for doing that.
Ben Menachem. My name is Ben Menachem.
Thank you, Mr. Ben Menachem. I apologize. I was Hispanicizing your name. We cut to just the second name. Thank you, sir. Given that the precarious perch that Israel sits in right now, given that it is being considered in many ways a pariah state by people all over the world, do you think it helps the cause or hurts the cause for Mr. Netanyahu to suddenly get on a plane, fly to Washington, and start, as some have said, coaching Mr. Trump on what to do regarding Iran? Do you think he should have waited, or do you think maybe he should have done it over the phone?
You are describing President Trump as a small boy. He doesn't know and has to have a mentor called Benjamin Netanyahu. This is not true at all, you know, because President Trump, for many years, even before he was president, he was speaking against Iran. So he doesn't need Netanyahu to coach him and to encourage him. I have to remind you.
So then why go? So if he doesn't need it, why would Bibi Netanyahu further antagonize Americans who are starting to feel like it's not about America first, it's about Israel first?
Look, the purpose of the visit of Netanyahu was, first of all, he was invited by President Trump, and this is to do with the negotiations behind the scenes, a coordination, I would say, rather coordination between the two countries about the policy towards Iran, about the different scenarios if the Iranians will not defuse their nuclear and ballistic missiles programs. It was just consultations and coordination. To say that Netanyahu is coaching President Trump, I think this is ridiculous.
Coordination sounds a lot like coaching in this sense.
There's no coaching. Look, go check the statements of President Trump before he became president many years ago, and you will see what he thinks about Iran. He doesn't need Netanyahu to encourage it.
But $250 million from Maryam Adelson certainly helps to pave the way, I think, for some good coaching.
What are you trying to say, Chris? Legitimate. What are you trying to say?
Listen,
this is
it's a proven every it's a proven fact at this point. It's a proven fact.
One at a time, gentlemen. One at a time.
Listen,
Chris,
It's a proven fact at this point that the lobby in the U.S. for war and for strengthening Israel's position has been further strengthened and enhanced by massive campaign contributions, moneyed interests, into especially Trump and the Republican Party. We're talking about $250 million alone from Maryam Adelson, from one person who themselves could not say whether their loyalty was to the United States or to Israel. Hmm. But as an American citizen, I would say
Is
that your loyalty should be
I
for USA.
Is it illegal? Is President Trump the first president that gets donations? Every American president gets donations.
I'm not saying that every other president is clear. I'm simply saying that Benjamin Netanyahu has an outsized influence now because of the moneyed interests that have been poured into President Trump.
But wait a minute.
Just for your information, the relationship, personal relationship between Miriam Adelson and Netanyahu are horrible, and they are not good friends
no
at
problem,
all.
No problem, but
and
both serve Israel.
Mr. Ben Menachem, let me ask you a question. Are you on the record here on our air saying it's perfectly fine for a country to give hundreds of millions of dollars to the president of another country? Are you saying that?
Miriam Adelson is not a representative of the state of Israel. And she did not give the money, the donation, in the name of Israel. This is done privately without any connection to the Israeli government. On the contrary, she's against the Israeli government. So how can you say that Israel is the one who's giving the hundreds of billions of dollars to the
Okay, what about AIPAC? What about AIPAC? They apparently have given 94% of Congress money directly, and the minimum that any congressman has gotten is over $110,000. I mean, that's direct money from AIPAC. Are they just citizens who have no connection to Israel?
AIPAC is a lobby. They are not representing the state of Israel. They are a lobby organization in the United States. You can find different organizations that are giving money to politicians, to American politicians. What is got to do with the Israeli government?
They have an Israeli flag on their logo. They have an Israeli flag on their logo at their events. Netanyahu speaks at their events. You tell me how it's supposed to be seen.
Not only Netanyahu speak at their events, all the prime ministers that belong to the other parties also speak there. It's not only Netanyahu.
All the more reason that it's connected to the Israeli government, of all factions of the Israeli government.
I'm just wondering, is there another...
No, there are political parties that are not part of the... Even the Israeli opposition, they deliver speeches in the conventions of AIPAC. What has that to do with the money?
But I'm
There's nothing to do with the money. If they are rich Jews in the United States, they want to contribute money to the American politician. This is a private business. It doesn't have any connection to Israel.
But what other country has an organization inside the United States that gives money to 94% of the politicians and gives at minimum $120,000?
Qatar. Yes.
Well, show me the Qatar lobby group. I want to see it.
Go check.
I have no evidence for it. What evidence?
Go check and see how many lobby organizations that are associated with Qatar in the United States. Go and check it and see if I'm right or wrong.
I can check it, and I have seen no evidence of that. I have seen personal evidence of Trump receiving a massive jet plane from the Qataris.
I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example. The campaign of Hillary Clinton, some of it was financed by Qatar. And even one of the ministers of the Qatar government admitted to it. Go check it. They got the personal grant from the Qatarian government, about $50,000 or something like that.
$50,000 compared to hundreds of millions? Please. I mean, this is like a small example.
Look, I don't live in the United States. I don't know exactly what is going on there as far as politics are concerned. But I know, for instance, I gave you an example of Hillary Clinton, and that was financed by Qatar in the campaign for the presidency. So go check it out and see if I'm wrong or right.
Just Google it.
You will find it on Google.
Final point.
I want to ask a question. Hold on. I just want to make sure. I want to clarify one thing that has been left out here. Mr. Ben-Menachem, would you condemn the language used by the Israeli government, Amalek, and this kind of language, human animals, for the Palestinian people?
What? Give me the quote. I don't know what you mean exactly. I don't represent the Israeli government. Let's put the record straight.
Oh, no, of course I know you don't. I'm just curious, as a journalist, as an Israeli journalist, as someone who upholds some ethical and moral principles. Do you agree with the language of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir?
I don't like the use of such a language, if it's true what you're saying.
Yeah.
Not against Palestinians, not against Israelis. This is not the way to make a dialogue, a peaceful dialogue. Of course I'm against using these terms, but from both sides, not only from one side.
Gentlemen, let's talk about this before we go, because the main reason we wanted to have this conversation was to talk about what's happening right now with Iran. And Iran is saying, look, if we're struck, we've got enough missiles now and we've got enough weapons that we're going to hit back. And we're going to hit every single base that the United States has, and we're going to hit Israel as well. I mean, that would be a hell of a conflagration, wouldn't it? That would be a very serious situation economically if the Gulf of Hormuz is closed. Mr. Ben-Hanachen, how concerned are you about this? Does it matter that Iran may have the capabilities to create this kind of situation? Or do you think it's still worth it if they don't agree?
This is horrible. If there will be a war, I presume that it will be a regional war. It will not be only an exchange of fire between the United States and Iran. Of course, the Iranians, they're saying that. They will make a regional war. They will attack Israel. They will attack the American bases in the Arab countries, in the Gulf countries.
Can you blame them? Can you blame them? I mean, wouldn't you?
I cannot. I'm not the judge here to blame. I'm just saying that, of course, a war is bad for everyone.
Yes.
Because when there is a war, you know how it starts. You can never know how it will finish. So, of course, we have to do everything to avoid war.
So
I'm not supporting any war.
So if the Iranians come back and say, look, we're willing to minimize our depletion of uranium to this level, whatever it is, 3.5%, 3.4%, something a little better than what they did with the JCPOA and what they gave to Mr. Obama, then would you be willing to encourage your country to walk away and say, good, that's all we want. We don't want them to have nukes. They have agreed not to have nukes. They're willing to have us test every month and go in there. Is that a good enough deal?
Listen, we have a bad experience with the Iranians because the JCPO, as you mentioned, it was signed in 2015.
Yeah.
They committed themselves not to make nuclear weapons, and they committed themselves not to enrich more than, I don't remember how many percents of uranium.
3.66.
Okay, not only that they violated it, they also had a secret nuclear weapon to make a nuclear bomb.
There's no evidence of that. Iran never violated it. The United States violated it.
Let me finish. I didn't disturb you. And at the last minute, Israel attacked the nuclear facilities, and the United States also helped Israel to attack these nuclear facilities, and President Trump came out and said it very clearly. They were a few weeks away from making a nuclear weapon. So how can we believe now the Iranians, after they violated the agreement of 2015 and make another agreement with them, they will just wait until President Trump is out of office and they resume the nuclear weapon again.
We're down to 1 minute, gentlemen, before we run out of time. I guess, Chris, final word on who can or can't be trusted on this issue. You've heard what Mr. Ben Manachin said.
Iran has come to the table at multiple times to solve this issue. Iran signed the JCPOA, the United States unilaterally and illegally withdrew from it, and then imposed maximalist sanctions. Israel struck first, the United States and Iran were in negotiations, and the United States, behind the back of the Iranian negotiators, gave the green light for Israel and a combined effort later by the United States to strike Iran in a 12-day war that was offensive against Iran. That's twice, and I can't give you all the other scenarios that goes back to Khatami. You remember, you were a journalist in the 90s, the relationship during the Clinton era with Iran. The main thing is this. At every point, the United States, with the push of Israel, have violated every agreement and diplomatic effort to find a peaceful solution because their goal is regime change. And why do I know that to be the case? Because Reza Pahlavi, the son of the deposed Shah, is a welcome guest. Mujahideen Halka, terrorist organization, is supported and based in Albania with U.S. and Israeli support. There's no peace here that can come if they are not serious about diplomacy. And at this point, they're not serious about diplomacy.
You both make your points well, and I thank you so much. This has been a lively debate and one that's, I think, important for people to hear the perspectives on this situation. It's way too terrible what can come out of this for not to have this kind of conversation with all of the points of view being taken into account. So my thanks to you, Mr. Ben Manachin, for coming on and sharing your perspective. I appreciate you very much.
Thank you. And I appreciate you as well,
Chris Hlali, for coming on and sharing our perspective. And hopefully we'll continue talking before anything else happens, which could be much worse. Again, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I want to tell you that from covering Iran last week, we have gotten a lot of comments. And a lot of it has been, you know, well, should I say, filled with likes and also filled with hate, as is often the case with these kinds of stories. Here's a sample. Viaggi3945 says, disgusting that Rick gives these monsters a platform. Shame on you. He's speaking about the fact that I was in Iran talking to the Iranians about their perspective on this. He says it shouldn't be heard. The Riddler says, this is real journalism and glory to the people of Iran. Different perspective. But Zach Khan accuses me of playing the game that the vile Islamic regime wants. Shame on you, he says, for the hypocrisy that you are engaging in. But then Dira Rob One says, great interview, objective, open, and courageous. Kuro Jack, 6874, says, you know, the world is screwed up when Rick Sanchez does not have at least 1 million subscribers on YouTube. Good point, Mr. Kuro. And that is why we're going to soon be combining our efforts with a more freedom-based platform that doesn't suppress views. It's called BitChute, by the way. Look it up and look for more details very, very soon. As usual, all the feedback is appreciated. Check out my page on YouTube called Journalistically Speaking. I'm also on X. I go by Rick Sanchez TV there. And as I just mentioned, on BitChute, soon to come. Thank you so much for being with us. These are the types of conversations, debates, if you will, that we're going to have more of because we think it's important for people to be able to hear with passion how they feel about these topics before it's too late. Thank you for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.